It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about some of the top science news with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak, including new breakthroughs in facial reconstruction.
First, education has been in the news in Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker asked the state legislature to pass a bill in January that would repeal the Common Core state standards and set new requirements.
But some local districts have decided to stick with Common Core standards, saying they've already invested time and money into implementing them. One of those school districts is in Clinton. Randy Ruffsland is with us now. He's the district administrator for the Clinton Community School District. Randy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So how long have you had Common Core standards in place there in Clinton?
Well, the state adopted them in 2010. Like most of the school districts in the state, we thought that was a great idea. We still feel that way. And so since 2010, in one form or another, we've been working and progressing with either with curriculum and training staff to align our curriculum with the Common Core standards.
So from the student perspective, are they seeing this curriculum in place?
They are in most of our subject areas. The Common Core is not completed yet in social sciences. And it's still a little bit of a work in progress in science, but in English, language, arts, and in math, we've been, those two subject areas we've been working, and we are using those as the standards that our curriculum is trying to meet, yes.
So has there been a big culture shock among teachers and students where they are seeing Common Core in place?
No, not at all. The standards are just that. They're standards. They're not actually the curriculum themselves. The curriculum helps us get to those standards, but the standards are used as, if you will, the benchmarks that we're trying to get to, the essential learning that we want out of 10th grade English or kindergarten math. We've had standards in Wisconsin for a long time. The difference is the Wisconsin standards, while they were adequate, really were not in line with, frankly, they weren't that rigorous in comparison to the people that were, as educators, not only in Wisconsin but nationwide, are being compared with. And that includes other states as well as the international set.
What did it take to start adapting your curriculum to these standards? How much time and effort has gone into this?
Quite a bit. The time that has been put in, and not just in my district, but I know across the state, the time that has been put into working on the standards has been substantial. And it's substantial in the amount of time that you bring staff in to work on it, whether it's during the summer, during the school year, and it's an ongoing process. It never ends. And so we have put literally thousands of hours into it over the last 4 years with staff time, substitute teaching, bringing subs in so that our staff can work collaboratively on this because it is a collaborative effort. It's not people working alone in a room. It's all of my teachers who are English language arts teachers in our district working together to identify the standards and how we're going to get there, or in math, et cetera. So the amount of time and effort has been quite high.
So there's been a growing chorus of criticism of a lot of the Common Core, I guess, as a general concept, really. And we've heard from state lawmakers, including on this show, saying it's time to step away from Common Core. Now, last month, we heard from Governor Walker saying, legislators, come January, I'd like you to tackle this and end Common Core in Wisconsin. What was your response when you heard about that?
Well, The quickest response I can give you is that it's election time. And unfortunately, the Common Core, which started with the governor's, the National Governor's Conference way back when, has become politicized, not only in Wisconsin, but across the nation. The criticism is not educational. It's all about politics. Because if you look at it strictly from an educational point of view, there's little to criticize. I mean, you can pick out an individual standard here or there, but in general, it's not about education. It's about politics. And for me, it's frustrating as somebody who has a large amount of international experience. We keep hearing from people that we need to step it up and compete with the internationally. And we're compared with the schools in China and Finland and et cetera, all over the world. And the way to do that is to up our standards. Now, those same people, frankly, are criticizing us when we're amping up the standards. It makes little or no sense to me.
One of the critiques we're hearing at the local level is that these are policies developed for the national stage. While they weren't put down, you know, laid down by the Obama administration, the federal government is pressuring states to adopt them. The argument goes, we should be setting our own local standards, our own state standards, at least here in Wisconsin, where we're closer to the ground.
Well, and I understand that local control is important in a lot of things, I think. But when we're talking about education standards, it's fine if we're only going to compare our students, and if our students are only going to compete against kids in Wisconsin. But the reality is that's not the case anymore. Our kids are competing for places in colleges and in the job force with kids from every state in the union and, frankly, from every nation in the world. And we are one of the few countries that does not have a national curriculum. It's amazing to me that it's taken this long to get to this conversation. Quite frankly, it's long overdue, in my opinion.
You are planning to continue, move forward with Common Core in spite of the governor's call. Is that the reaction we're hearing from a lot of districts?
I think if you polled the 424 or so public school districts in the state, I think you would find the majority are planning on moving forward. I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but I know in our district we believe that the Common Core has upped the level of education in our district, and it's something we're not where we need to be yet. We're going to continue working to get there, but we believe the Common Core helps us get there.
Well, what happens in your district if, come January, the state legislature passes a bill repealing the Common Core standards for Wisconsin? Are you left at square one?
Yes and no. No in the sense that going back to the local control argument, each school district can choose to follow the standards, whether or not the state has repealed them as the overriding set of standards. We can still adopt them. There's nothing in state law, unless they do something with any new legislation, that would prohibit us from going there. The yes part of it is with the adoption of the Common Core, part of that was an adoption of a new state assessment, the Smarter Balance Assessment, which is going to be given this coming spring of 2015. That assessment is tied in to the Common Core standards. The new teacher evaluation system that starts this fall across the state has components that are tied in one way or another to the Common Core standards. So you're looking at two very significant pieces of data and information gathering, both from a staff evaluation point of view and then from student assessment, that are tied into the Common Core. So if you repeal the Common Core, we're left really with an invalid state assessment. And it also puts a hole in the new teacher evaluation system as well.
Randy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Randy Refsland. He's district administrator for the Clinton Community School District. Next month's issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands tomorrow. We have editor Gemma Tarlak with us now for a look at some of the top news from science and technology.
Gemma joins us every month at this time. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Doing okay.
Well, this month's cover story, it follows a plastic surgeon who left his lucrative private practice to join the Army. He'd sort of seen enough and wanted to help and went on to, he's doing a lot of exciting things in the field of facial reconstruction. Tell us about Colonel Robert Hale.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing. He was kind of the stereotypical Los Angeles plastic surgeon, and as he puts it, he was taking care of rich people with small problems. And shortly after 9/11, they asked him, the Army asked him to help out, so he was in these field hospitals treating these soldiers coming in with just incredibly devastating injuries. And the thing is, you know, really, warfare has changed, and facial reconstructive surgery has not kept up with it. And Robert Hale wants to be the difference. So he's really bringing facial reconstructive surgery, most of which is still based on the World War I technologies, he's bringing it into the 21st century with some things like spray-on skin cells, a mask that you can put over a soldier very shortly after injury that helps them to begin healing immediately and prevent some of the scarring. They're making bones, bone scaffolding out of biodegradable material. It's fantastic stuff, and just knowing it's going to help you know, the armed forces folks is just fantastic.
The doctor in this story is quite a story himself, and seeing this contradiction between the high-tech stuff being available for the people who need it the least, well, we've got these horrific injuries with, as you say, World War I era science and technology.
Exactly. And, you know, he just has such a straightforward manner, just like, yeah, I'm not doing this. I lost my, you know, my passion for nose jobs, and I'm going to put my skills where they really count. And in addition to him, the story of an Army man, Todd Nelson, who experienced an IED attack, and it really, the injuries were absolutely devastating to him. And he actually became kind of an inspiration to Colonel Robert Hale as he was working on him, working to, you know, help him get back to the face he knew and the face his wife and kids knew. And it's really, it's such a touching story and an important story as well, scientifically.
And it turns out the skin on the face is not like other skin. It's special, and it requires specialized treatment, especially to keep the bacteria out, to keep inflammation and infection from setting in. So what has Colonel Hale done to innovate in that era?
Well, there's so many different ways the face is different. I mean, not just the skin, which when you think about it, our facial expressions are so much more extensive and nuanced than, say, our elbow expressions. You know what I mean? Like, our face does so much more in terms of expressions and the fluidity and the plasticity of it, but also just our bones. Our facial bones are much more complex than, say, you know, your average femur. So he actually is working with a lot of different people in a lot of different fields saying, hey, help us out. And he's bringing in innovation from different areas. Things like, for example, the spray-on skin cells I talked to you about. They figured a way to take like a postage size piece of skin in a biopsy, say from someone's scalp, and actually create spray-on skin cells from their own skin. And that way, you know, when you think about it, the color of your scalp is a lot closer to the color of your face than, again, say, your elbow. So they're letting not only soldiers heal faster, but also leave them with less scarring. And, you know, that's so important. The Army guy profiled in the story talks about how all he wanted to do was be able to open his mouth enough to eat a hamburger. I mean, when you're talking about that kind of devastating facial injury, this is just such great science.
And he also is working on something, a biomask.
Yes. You know, when you think about it, everyone knows what dental plaque is, right? That stuff that forms on your teeth, even if you're pretty religious about, you know, brushing and flossing and all that stuff. Well, biofilms, which is what dental plaque is, they form everywhere where bacteria can get a leg up on our skin. And it's particularly devastating with facial injuries, because if a biofilm forms on an injured arm and it gets really bad, well, you know, they can do an amputation. But if a biofilm forms on your face, you can't amputate your face. So this was something they were really struggling with, and he created with his team this mask that actually fits right over the face, and it creates not only a protective barrier from bacteria that wants to get in and do something naughty, but it also actually creates this negative vacuum that helps speeds recovery. It's full of antibiotics, so right away they're getting treatment, and it's already making a big difference in terms of the injuries.
So is it expected to be more widespread, more available soon?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they're refining the technique all the time. In fact, since since the story started the editing process and actually got published, they've made several advances on that biomask. So there's a lot of innovation, and it's ongoing. And I think a lot of it is just driven by Colonel Hale's passion for the soldiers that he's treating.
Well, you also follow in this issue of Discover another person with a passion for innovation, Jose Gomez Marquez. What's his story?
Oh, I love Jose. Okay, so he is the head of something called the Little Devices Lab at MIT in Boston. And he almost died when he was newborn. He was born in Honduras, and he was born premature, had a lot of issues, barely survived because there was not the medical equipment he needed at that hospital. It created this passion in him to find ways for people in developing countries to have medical equipment that will save lives and improve lives, even if they don't have the money for it. So what he does, he's all about hacking. That's like his favorite word. Every other word out of his mouth is hacking, because he's all about finding ways to create equipment from Lego, from dollar store finds, from just random things, and make actually usable medical technology from it. For example, one of the things his lab team has designed, it's like a Lego tower with a syringe and some plastic gears, and it actually creates a paper diagnostic so that, you know, a doctor in the field can diagnose malaria or dengue fever. It you know, costs couple bucks to put together, and it actually does the same job as a machine called a liquid handler, which would cost $100,000. So he is all about making medical equipment accessible, even if you're somewhere remote, even if you don't have a budget. It's fascinating stuff he's doing.
Yeah, it's incredible, the stuff he comes up with. Is something that's going to be easily replicatable for somebody else, though, in another country?
Oh, yeah, that's the whole point. I mean, his whole thing is, if you are, you know, again, a doctor in some remote field hospital, you just don't have $250,000 to spend on a piece of equipment. And if that piece of equipment breaks down, you can't mail it back to Germany or to California or wherever it came from. So his whole thing is, okay, let's find a hack that creates a device that will do the job of the expensive one, and if it breaks, something that is easy enough to repair, easy enough to customize. Another example, he created a special TB compliance program in Ethiopia where they decided they were going to use cell phone technology so that someone in a remote location could still be checked on, just to make sure they were taking their TB medication. As you know, for tuberculosis, it's very important to take the full course of medication. And so they created this whole cell phone technology system, and then they got to Ethiopia to test it out, and they realized the actual light, the alarm light that would go off, was red, and that the local folks were very superstitious of that color. So they just kind of swapped it out for what was locally available and locally acceptable culturally. So he's always doing things like that. He's kind of a, you know, the IKEA hacker of medical technology.
Gemma, we have just a couple minutes left. We promised some cat talk. You wrote a piece on what we don't know about cats. Give us a taste of what we don't know about cats.
Oh, my gosh. There's so much to tell you about cats. Cats, their eyes are huge. They're so huge that they have a lot of trouble focusing. That's why indoor cats tend to be nearsighted and outdoor cats tend to be farsighted, because their eyes are actually too big to adjust like ours can. And let me give you a quick word on polydactyl cats, with more than the usual number of toes. They can actually trace the voyages of sailors by the number of polydactyl cats on river deltas and seaboard cities, because polydactyls were very popular with sailors.
And it's crazy. Cats can't taste sweetness, it turns out.
It's true. It's true, no matter what you think. In fact, we had some readers take exception to that online, commenting, "My mittens loves her ice cream." But the truth of the matter is, cats really lack the genes that express the sweetness receptors. And, you know, I'm sorry. I'm glad Mittens likes her rocky road or whatever. But no, they cannot taste sweetness. They're tasting something else if they like ice cream.
Well, we've got a link to the rest of those pieces of information about cats at the Central Time Facebook page. Gemma, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She is senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the latest news from the worlds of science and technology.
So cats have giant eyes, which I guess explains part of why they're so cute.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know if she got into that. But yeah, no, there's psychology, like Japanese anime, that's part of the whole idea, Bambi, mm-hmm. right? The cats are the Bambis of cat world.
Anyway, lots of cute facts there about cats.
Back pain is incredibly common. It's the second most common neurological ailment in the United States, after headaches. It affects workers and employers in the arena of employee compensation, and it can move from a physical problem to one that's emotional and social.
Our next guest specializes in treating back pain and says it's time for doctors to take it seriously. Jack Stern is a neurosurgeon specializing in spine surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College. He's also the co-founder of Spine Options, New York's first and only facility devoted to non-surgical care of back and neck pain. He's the author of Ending Back Pain, 5 Powerful Steps to Diagnose, Understand, and Treat Your Ailing Back. Dr. Stern, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, and thank you for inviting me on.
Well, it seems like a lot of people in their lives have back pain at one time or another. It's such a common complaint. Do patients and their doctors take it seriously enough?
Unfortunately and fortunately, they don't. Fortunately, because for most of us, back pain is a very self-limiting disease, and the old adage, take 2 pills and call me in the morning or perhaps call me in a week, usually works. Unfortunately, there are a significant number of patients who have recurrent bouts of back pain and or have chronic back pain for whom those 2 pills just don't work.
Well, and you tell a story about one of the reasons you decided to dig deeper into back pain, and it's part of why you have more compassion for people who suffer from it. Your wife decided to get you a, quote, special massage on your birthday, which kind of took a wrong turn. You want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, Judy said my birthday gift was going to be a very gentle massage. And as it turns out, this very large woman ended up showing up to our home and walked on my back. And after she walked on my back, I had significant trouble walking. And for the first time, I really felt what my patients must feel when they have severe back pain and inability to move or to walk. And that was really the incentive in many ways for me to write this book. A sense of compassion and empathy for my patients who, along the way, really have been my greatest teachers. So, yeah, that's how it began.
Was that the first time you had back pain that severe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like many others, I've had a bout of back pain before that, but never such severe back pain. Interesting, what I stress in my book, Ending Back Pain, is the fact that back pain itself isn't really a diagnosis. And it really requires additional thought on the part of the physician to find out the source of your back pain. And only if one really delves into finding out the source of the back pain can you really treat back pain effectively. And that's one of the points I try to make again and again to my patients and make that point in the book.
Right. I mean, if you just take the phrase back pain, it's kind of nebulous. You don't really know what you're talking about. So how do you get to a diagnosis about just what exactly is going on?
First part is because, thank goodness for most of us, it's such a self-limiting disease, it's learning how to advocate for oneself with the healthcare system. Because most of us, when we have back pain, get short shrift. So the first point I try to make is learn how to advocate for yourself in the healthcare system. Number two, as part of being a good advocate, be able to identify where your pain is, what its characteristics are, when it comes on, what makes it worse, what makes it better. Is it back pain or is it leg pain? Is it one leg? Is it both legs? Has it affected any other functioning like weakness or difficulty going to the bathroom? So point two is you have to be a very strong advocate. And number three is ensuring that the right diagnostic tests are done, usually an MRI or a CAT scan, sometimes just simply an X-ray to help make that diagnosis. Only with that diagnosis, only once you and the physician in partnership have made a diagnosis, can the treatment options be presented to you. And although I'm a neurosurgeon, this book is not about surgery. It's about providing people with a proper diagnosis and then providing them with the treatment options, the variety of treatment options. In this case, from least invasive treatment options to most invasive treatment options, And because I'm also a PhD and have done research, it was really important for me in this book to provide the reader with scientific data on each one of the treatment options, particularly those studies that were double-blinded, so that this is a book for educating oneself and making really intelligent decisions about how to treat your back pain and what the source of that back pain is.
Do you think that more people get steered towards surgery or want themselves to have surgery than is really necessary?
That is a keen question. I don't think any sensible person, except when they're in extreme pain or have a real neurologic deficit, you know, weakness or loss of sensation, wants surgery. I think there's too much surgery going on for chronic low back pain. And that is clearly being addressed by our medical society, by physicians itself, trying to further define which patients are appropriate for surgery. The number of patients who have had back surgery has increased almost logarithmically over the last 10 years. And if one really looks at the criteria for those patients who have had surgery, the criteria seem to be vague, which usually means to those of us who look at data critically that there are a lot of patients or a significant number of patients who probably have had surgery that might not have warranted it.
Well, you mentioned lower back pain. Now, that's a common one. It afflicts a lot of people over the course of their lives. What are some of the things that can cause lower back pain?
Well, overwhelmingly, lower back pain is caused by some sort of muscle spasm. You took the air conditioner out of the window. It was much strong, it was much heavier than you thought it would be, and you put it down and you say, oh, my back aches, and you've probably pulled a muscle. Or what I call the weekend warriors go out there on the weekend and do sports where the rest of the week they're sitting behind the computer, or it's a really snowy, wintry day, and you decide to go out there and shovel the driveway of 6 inches of snow. So over the course of a lifetime, most people do something foolish like that. We as Americans tend to not be in the best of shape, and we as a nation also have a problem with obesity. So the combination of those two things and being foolish with one's body mechanics usually leads to back pain that's based on some sort of ligamentous or bony pain.
Do all cultures experience back pain, you know, at the same rates?
No. It's interesting, in the book, Ending Back Pain, I talk about the incidence of back pain in East Germany and the incidence of West Germany before the two, East Berlin and West Berlin, before the two cities were united. And the incidence of back pain was much lower in East Berlin than in West Berlin, and yet after about 5 years, the incidence became the same once the two cities became one. And there are a number of reasons for that. Some of it has to do with the fact that there was suddenly better health care, so people who had back pain now had the opportunity to seek help for it. The other was that there was a greater awareness that people had back pain. And number three, in most civilized or third world countries, people do not have to work if they have back pain. We have social systems in place that help individuals who have pain, not only back pain, but all sorts of pain, but in this case, back pain in particular, so that the workplace has to provide them with time off and with the ability to seek health care, which wasn't the paradigm in East Berlin before the two merged. So, yes, there are vast differences in many countries, even in cities, and it's multifactorial. There are many factors that go into why that is.
We're talking right now with Dr. Jack Stern about healing back pain. He's a neurosurgeon at Weill Cornell Medical College. His new book is called Ending Back Pain, 5 Powerful Steps to Diagnose, Understand, and Treat Your Ailing Back.
And you can call in with your experiences and your questions. Do you suffer from back pain? How do you cope? Did you find the right treatment or the cause? Or did it take some doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with a specialist about curing back pain right now. Dr. Jack Stern is a neurosurgeon specializing in spine surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College. He's also the founder of the Spine Options, a facility devoted to non-surgical care of back and neck pain. And he's the author of the book, Ending Back Pain.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you have back pain? What makes it come and go? Did you find the right treatment right away, or did it take a while? Or are you still looking? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go to our phone lines right now. We've got Kent with us from Porterfield. Hi, Kent.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. What do you think about this, the back pain issue?
Well, I've got it bad. I mean, I've been working construction for most of my life. I'm going to be 54 this year. I've got lower back pain. I go to the chiropractor. Any pain around my neck and between my shoulders and things like that, he can set it and get it back into position. And I ice it down. It helps out a lot. But lately, in the last probably 2 years or so, my back has been getting real bad, my lower back. Now, does he think I should go have a X-ray or something done to look at it to see what's going on down there?
All right, well, let's find out. Dr. Stern, what do you think about this case?
Well, our caller is such a classic. You're such a classic patient of someone who does hard work for all your life and have used your back and probably, by the nature of the work you do, have overused or abused your back. Quite frankly, if you do an MRI on you or a CAT scan or an X-ray, we're going to find significant amount of disc degeneration. You've just used up your parts beyond their ability to repair themselves. And for someone like you, surgery is highly unlikely to help you. The things that might help are, one, changing the work you do, and I know that's a challenging concept. Number two is to learn techniques to use better body mechanics. And number three, your internist or your family doctor may suggest some intermittent trials of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to help you through those toughest parts of the day or toughest parts of the week. But in essence, there are no magic answers to the problem you have. And the problem you have is widespread.
All right. Well, Kent, I hope that helps and some of those suggestions bring you some relief. Now, Kent referenced going to a chiropractor, getting realigned or what have you, and feeling okay for a while. Is that something that you recommend, Dr. Stern? What about chiropractors?
Yes. Again, in Ending Back Pain, I look at what studies have been done to actually validate a treatment. And there are a number of very good studies in the medical literature that validate the use of chiropractic. So that I frequently send patients to chiropractors. Over the years, I have had many chiropractors send me patients. I have actually been on the board of the New York Chiropractic College. So I have found chiropractic very useful for a great many of my patients. And like every other treatment modality, it's not for every patient. So sometimes it's a hit and miss sort of thing where you send the patients to the chiropractor. And sometimes in this case, it helps for the patient's neck, but not for the patient's low back. But to answer your question, yes, I send patients to chiropractors frequently. And I find that in a significant number of instances, patients benefit.
And what about other forms of complementary medicine that you wouldn't find, you know, if you went to your clinic, yoga or Pilates, things like that, acupuncture?
Well, all those modalities have strong functionality in terms of treating patients' back pain. There's certainly evidence that acupuncture can be effective in treating back pain. I, for one, really suggest strongly that patients do yoga or Pilates because I believe that if you learn to stretch, you're less likely to injure yourself. And both yoga and Pilates stress flexibility. The other thing that I advocate for is patients attempting something called the Alexander technique, which is a mind-body technique that teaches individuals, and it's used frequently for actors and musicians to use their body mechanics better. This might not be appropriate for someone who does heavy labor, although it could be, but all these techniques are helpful. The trick is, or the key is always, trying to figure out in whom they will be helpful. And sometimes that's really an issue of trial and error.
All right. Well, we thank you, Kent. And we'll move now to Therese in Viroqua. Hi there.
Hi. Well, my issue would be upper back pain that includes the shoulders and neck that I've had for years, starting out mildly when I was in my 20s, and then just gotten worse over the years. Lately, the latest thing I tried was a couple years ago, tried some physical therapy, and they said I was overusing my shoulder muscles right at the top of your muscles, like they're overdeveloped. And they taught me some exercises how to strengthen the other muscles to avoid using those muscles instead, the ones on the shoulders on top. And it did not help. I tried that for a few months, and they assured me I was doing the exercises like they wanted me to. And it didn't help, and it's just gotten worse over the years where it radiates all the way down to my arms and my hands even, so it's hard to do any heavy lifting or repetitive work with my arms or hands.
All right. What do you think, Dr. Stern? Pain that radiates down from her shoulder.
First, I would say that obviously this is not an issue of low back pain. This is really an issue of cervical and neck pain. And what alarms me a bit about what you're saying is that it's not just that you have the pain now in your neck or in your shoulders, but it's radiating to your arms. So it seems to be more than just one or two muscle groups, but in fact may be involving the nerves that extend from your neck, actually from your spinal cord, in your neck, in your cervical spine, down to your arms. I would strongly suggest, if you haven't already, that you have your internist or your neurologist look at you carefully to make sure that you haven't developed any muscle atrophy, that you haven't developed any loss of strength or any loss of sensation, in which case they would probably recommend, and I would certainly endorse that, that you get an MRI just to make sure that there isn't compression on the nerves and it's really a nerve problem that's manifesting itself as a muscle problem.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Therese. I wish you well on that. And one more quick call from Ben here in Milwaukee. Ben, how's your back?
Yes, hello. I'm 28 years old, and I experienced a what they call spondylolisthesis in my L5 when I was 15 years old. I just wanted to call and reiterate what the doctor is saying, that I saw many different orthopedic surgeons, and many of them were willing to perform a spinal fusion at a very young age. And, of course, I was also sent to physical therapy, and I performed some other duties to try to strengthen my core. But I was just amazed at how many orthopedic surgeons were ready to jump into the OR. And I just wanted to say to anybody out there that you got to give a lower back pain some time. With somebody who's been living with it for 13 years, there are definitely other activities that you can do. And as he said, stretching and, manipulating the way that you perform an activity to be able to function it properly without experiencing pain.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ben. And Ben, echoing, I guess, what you had said about a lot of people wanting to go into surgery, but maybe spending some time with it. Do people need to spend more time getting non-surgical resolution?
I love what Ben had to say. Ben has spondylolisthesis, which is probably a congenital condition where the bones in his spine didn't fuse properly. It's a congenital condition in a young person. And I see all the time what Ben has experienced, and that is that an orthopedist or even a spinal neurosurgeon sees that the bones haven't fused and said, well, they're not fused. Let's take you to the operating room and let's fuse those bones. But Ben, and I'm sure at your age of 13, your parents were part of the decision-making process, were wise enough to say, let's just wait. Let's see if, as you said, Ben, let's see if we can strengthen your core see if they could take on a regimen of strengthening and stretching. And so many patients, like yourself, Ben, have avoided surgery because they were aware enough, alert enough, to realize that surgery, that there are other options, and you fortunately followed those options. That issue is addressed in my book, Ending Back Pain, and you speak as if you had already read the book, and obviously you haven't because it just came out, but this is what I stress in that book, that surgery and people like yourself is not the answer, that there are many other options.
Well, let's talk about some of those options. I mean, if you're someone who's had a acute back pain or any kind of back pain, once it goes away, you never want to go back there again. I've got about a minute left, but what can we do to keep our backs healthy?
The most important thing is stretching, a regular routine of stretching. Establishing any habit in our lives is challenging, any habit. So the habit of getting up and stretching for 5 or 10 minutes as we get up, or 5 or 10 minutes when we go to bed, is challenging. But I can tell you, if you have back pain, establishing a stretching regimen and establishing a simple core muscle strengthening core regimen will avoid recurrences of back pain. They are the key. And the other small hint is that when you suspect back pain coming on, quickly take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, since most of the symptoms you have are related to inflammation.
So an aspirin, ibuprofen.
Right, ibuprofen. Take it right away and watch how you're using your body. If you do those three things, you can probably either avoid having another episode of back pain or stop it in its tracks.
Well, Dr. Stern, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking to Jack Stern, a neurosurgeon specializing in spine surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College. He's also the co-founder of Spine Options, a facility devoted to non-surgical care of back and neck pain. His new book is called Ending Back Pain.